Yes, the seven seas of friendship. So I like Buddhist lists. On the last introductory course, somebody thought they were on a mathematics course because I was always going on about the four of this and the seven of this. I love all this. So I thought I'd do a list of my own when I decided to do this talk. I called it the Tiger's Cave. Last night I said I couldn't remember why, but Padmavadra actually just told you why I called it. That's what I wanted to say. But these seven C's are what I see as aspects and elements of friendship. And they're a sort of a path. They're sort of an eightfold path, but only seven of them. Because I'm going to talk about, in a way, friendship in the day-to-day. And in a way, you could say, I'm going to talk more about the samatha aspect of friendship, like the foundation, the calming down, all that sort of thing that sets you up for the vipassana, for the insight meditation. So this part is ordinary friendship moving to friendship in the good, to the Kalyana Mitra, to spiritual friendship. So hopefully this will, you know, give you some pointers, because I think sometimes we talk about spiritual friendship, and it's a bit like a lot of things in the Dharma. When people talk about things, you talk about the ideal a lot and people get very discouraged because they're not there. But actually, what we always talk about in meditation is you start from where you are. So we can start from friendliness and friendship, and we can move to Kalyana Mitrata, spiritual friendship. And I think this is the real, you know, this is the basis of our Sangha. And if we haven't got enough of this Kalyana Mitra in the Sangha doesn't survive. And I think the Sangha is important for the world. Anyway, good, I didn't write any of that down, so that's good. I will have a bit of trouble with my glasses because they're a different pair. So I want to talk about friendship and Kalyana Mitra as a key to developing and strengthening Sangha jewel. I'm very, very fortunate that all my life I've had good friends from as far as I can remember. And I was out the other day with Pablo Singer, a good friend of mine, and a couple of the guys from Cardiff. We went to see a concert and then we had lunch afterwards. And it was just lovely. We were there for about an hour and we didn't really do much, a bit of banter, you know, a bit of jokes. Bit talk about the music, blah, 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 bit talk about Dharma. Blah, blah. You know, it just sort of flowed around the table like this. And I went home and I just felt so good. It just felt like, God, it was quite beautiful, actually. And I remember that one of the guys there, that is not his experience of life at all. You know, it was for me, that's, you know, been my experience of life most of the time. And I said to him later, that's not usual for you, is it? He said, no. And it's the thing that's starting to change him. It's the thing that's starting to move him towards ordination. And I thought, God, I'm just so privileged. You know, all through my life, I've just had friends. When I came to Padmaloka, I was sort of adopted, in a way, by Subhuti and Sona and Padmavadra when he arrived here, Aloka, Surita. They adopted me. But in a way, they didn't do anything in terms of, you know, saying, oh, well, we look after you. They just, the way they were with each other, I just found incredibly, incredibly inspiring. You know, their friendships, you know, Padmavadra, Surita and Aloka and Subhutis and Sona are sort of my template, in a way, for my spiritual life in the movement. And the way they just conducted themselves, they worked hard, they played hard, they had fun, you know, difficulties, they worked them out, you know, very, very straightforwardly. And it was great. And I thought, well, I want to be part of this because I think, you know, this is the way, you know, interaction with other human beings, other men, you know, in a very, very sort of strong way. It wasn't, you know, there wasn't a lot of sensitivity in terms, you know, in the, the sentimental way. There was a lot of, of that in a very good way, but not in that sentimental way where we all have to look out for each other's feelings. You know, it's quite robust. And I sort of grew up in that sort of era where, you know, men's friendships were, you know, they were robust, and you know, it was a lot of banter. You know, you had to hold your end up, otherwise, you know, you went under. And I sort of quite like that, but I found, you know, in a certain way, I had to tone it down a bit. When you're chairman of the centre, as I have been one time, you have to sort of just consider other people. Although I still get away with some pretty good stuff now and again. So I do want to talk more about friendships between men. Now, there's nothing wrong with friendship with women. I've got some very good women friends, and one in particular is a source of great delight to me. But men and women are wired up differently. You know, physically, psychologically, emotionally, they're different. Okay, and if you don't realise that, you're in big trouble, right? And it's going to be a shock to you when you do. And also, there is an underlying myth, the male myth, which drives us, which is different from the underlying female myth that drives them, you know. And I sort of think of the male myth as that questing, snorting, you know, well, let's get on with it. Let's get into things with each other sort of myth. And that's what I love, you know, that sort of robustness. So men and women are different. So this is about friendships with men. So I'm going to amble into this a bit by, I want to talk about a bit about some writing on friendship, which I find them really inspiring. And I want to just talk briefly about three friendships in my life. And then I want to lead into the seven C's. So when I always think about this, when I always think about friendship, I always go back to a book called The Log of the Sea of Cortez by John Steinbeck. Now, it's a log of when he went with his friend Ed Ricketts on a marine, Ed Ricketts, a marine biologist. So they went on a trip in a sea, doing whatever marine biologists do. I don't know. But I've never read that part of it because it was written in 1958 and Ed Ricketts died in 1948. The first 65 pages are John Steinbeck just talking, writing about his friendship with Ed Ricketts. And it's the most beautiful thing you can read because it's just about a friendship. It's about a friendship. It's so affecting because there's this guy he talks about. He said, you may not recognise this man from the man I'm talking about here, but this is how I see him. This is how I experienced him. And this man had vices and virtues, all sorts of things. He had oddities, like we all are, you know. He had these little things that would irritate you, but he had sort of strong qualities. And they were friends for 18 years. And it shows in this thing. And I think one of the things that underlies it, what makes it really important to me, is they were both obviously searching for truth in their own way. Like John Steinbeck in his novels and that, his writing, was obviously searching for truth and meaning to me. And Ed Ricketts, in what he did and the way he dealt with people, was searching for truth. And one of the things John Steinbeck said about him was that he couldn't stand if the truth wasn't there. He couldn't stand it if people were false. You know, he really, really wanted authenticity with people. And, you know, he would put himself on the line and upset people for this quest for authenticity and truth. And it's only 65 pages, and I don't think it's in print anymore. In my copy, is that, you know, when you open it, it starts to fall apart, and it's sort of yellow pages. But I sort of have it in this little place in my room. And I sort of smell the mildew and think, I hope somebody reprints this, because, you know, this is a real testimony to real friendship in terms, which to me is moving towards a sort of spiritual element, you know, because they had high standards, they had ethics, etc. So I want to just drop in a few, say, three little examples of friendships of mine. So the first one is, the first friendship I can remember was when I was about 9 or 10 with a chap called Colin Dawes. Now, we were at school, and in the end we got separated in class because we couldn't stop talking and laughing so much. But we had this idea, we were going to be a comedy duo. Des and Dawes, we were going to be called. And we were going to go on stage, and we used to make comedy tapes all the time. And our parents used to listen to them, you know, and they were all based on Round the Horn and all those sort of programmes. And we used to invent worlds and armies and cultures, you know, because we both could draw. He was a very good artist and I was okay. But we used to invent all this stuff and live in our life for 2 years, I suppose. We just sort of, so in, we, you know, we were sort of inseparable. We couldn't go anywhere and do it. It's really strange because he never liked football. It's odd. And it's interesting to see as he passed his 11 plus and sort of went over there to wherever you go. And I didn't pass my 11 plus because I was too busy talking to him in class. And I went over there. And gradually, you know, by the time we were 16, I didn't know him anymore. And it's interesting how, you know, like the contextual thing of friendship, you know, I'm going to talk about a bit later, has an effect. The second friendship I want to talk about is a guy called Dennis Blackmore. And when I was whatever age I was, unsettled and in the early 70s, where you used to go travelling, didn't you, to find yourself. That's what we used to do in those. And I went to Australia and New Zealand. And I met Dennis Blackmore when I was working in the hospital. I was a porter, an orderly in the National Women's Hospital. And he was there. And he was like everything I wanted to be, Dennis. He was just like tall and handsome, like bright eyes, you know, been to the best school in New Zealand. And he was a dropout. He could sleep anywhere. It's fantastic. And he was bright, intelligent. He read all these counterculture novels. You know, he used to go around the house he shared with people. It was walls and walls of, you know, albums and Jeff and this Airplane, you know, all those underground groups. And that. Sometimes he didn't used to be in when I go around. They'd just say, man, you know, make yourself at home, you know, play some sounds. You know? Which I used to do. But eventually, we were sort of friends for about 6 years, into about 1980 or something. And he still lived in Australia and I come back to Britain. And his last letter to me, I told him that I was living in Rosary Road in Norwich, that I used to love walking around the cathedral grounds and the cloisters, and also that I was a Buddhist. I'd become a Buddhist then. It was the time when, you know, I'd started being involved. And he wrote back to me and he said, somebody's trying to tell you something. And I'm sitting here with this English clock ticking away my life. And he also sent me a book called Jono by David Malouf. And in this book, the narrator is this very, what he sees as a very ordinary bloke. And the hero he writes about, so to speak, is this very, very colourful character. And what the ordinary bloke couldn't see was his part in that friendship. And he sent me this book and I wrote back and I said, this is about us, isn't it? And it was. So there's another point there. We all have a part in the friendship. No, it's not just one way. And the last friendship I want to talk about is my friend Surina, who lived here and worked here together for 5 years. Started the support team with Sangadalia over there. Had many nights of ranting and inspiration in the caravans at what we were going to do with the world. And I'd always decided when I was ordained, because I thought this is just what you do. You know, you get ordained, you go and start a centre. I thought that's what everybody did. Even though the evidence was against that, I thought, well, you just go and start a centre. That's what you do. I mean, that's, you know, we're Buddhists, we're in the FWO, as it used to be called. And Banty went to the New Society, so he just went out and done it. So I had my training here, living here in this hothouse of friendship and challenge and all this. And me and Surina, we looked at a map. We have different versions of this, and Sangadeva might have a different version, because I think he was there when we first thought of it. But we looked at the map, and there's these cities in the country. Well, Cardiff hadn't got a centre, and it's a bit warmer down there, and it is up north. And so we went down, and we drove down, we stayed there, we looked around, thought, oh, this is good, we'll come and do it. So that's what we did. We lived in Barry, which is a very, 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 very... I can't say what Barry's like. It's, you know... It can be rough. It can be rough in parts. And it's by the sea. It can be quite beautiful in other parts. But we had a house, and so we used to do classes in our front room. And then after about a year or something, we thought, well, if we want to move on, we've got to buy a place. So we asked people to give us money. And we raised about, I think it was about £25,000. I'm still laughing. And then... then somebody loaned us £5,000, and then we got a bit of gift aid on something. And we went and we bought the centre. And we worked. God, we worked like, well, he worked like like absolute dog for about 2 months converting this place. You know, I used to go and pull a little bit of paint on the wall and he'd be, we're driving from Barry, you know, we do this place, we get pizza and beer, watch the World Cup, knock another wall down or something, paint another thing and create this centre. And I was talking to him recently, and he said that 5 years, that first 5 years, were the best of his life. Mm-hmm. He said, I've never enjoyed my life so much. He said, I can work. He's a school teacher now. He said, I can work. But he said, if the crack's no good, if there's no fun, you know, what's the point? And we had so many ideas and dreams. And Banty came down recently, and I said this, you know, a lot of them we haven't achieved. But we did something, you know, we did something. And it cemented our friendship, even though he's gone to university, gone to be a teacher, lives in Birmingham. There's a sort of unbroken bond between us that can't be, you know, it's different now. It's very, very different now. But it's a wonderful, you know, it was, he didn't talk to me when it first came in. Everybody else was wonderful to me, you know, friendly and kind. And he was like sulking around the edges, I thought. I thought, he's a funny boy. And then suddenly, I don't know, something clicked between us and we were sort of inseparable, living here and there. So we lived together for about 15 years, I think, and lived and worked together about 15 years. And we only nearly had a crossword once. And he said to me, why, you know, how can we get on so well? And given, because he's a pessimist and I'm an optimist, he's critical and I'm sort of procrastinating. You know, he wants to do everything now and I just sort of, let's think about it, you know. And I said, well, the thing is, we agree on all the big things. And I'm not bothered about all the small ones. You can do all that, but I'm not going to get involved in it. You know, I'm not going to get upset a cup isn't washed or anything like that. I said, if you want to, you can, but I'm not going to. And I said, I think that's why we get on so well. So we have a higher ideal above us. You know, we had this higher ideal, which takes me smoothly into the first of my C's. Now, these C's are sort of elements and aspects of friendship. This is what I see. And it's very much work in progress, this. Like friendships are. It's work in progress. I thought I'd do it. It came to me, so I thought I'd write a talk on it. And so it's different aspects all begin with the letter C. That's why it's obvious, really, isn't it? They all begin with the letter C. So I'm just going to read a quote from the Gandavyuha Sutra to start this one. So excuse me, because when I have to read, I haven't got my reading glasses. So, O son of noble family, you must be unwearied in your search for friends in the good life. You must never feel contented with merely seeing friends in the good life. You must never feel satisfied with merely conversing with friends in the good life. You must never abandon your intention of being in the company of friends in the good life. So the first of the C's is context. So I feel like I had this real revelation recently. I have revelations like this now and again. Well, quite often actually, but I don't. But the revelation was that most friendships are contextual. And like I went to work. I went to work. I got really good friends with people. I changed my job, went to the other job, thought I've got really, really well with these people. I'll see them again. They fade out. You know, you're interested in football, you go to football with people, you suddenly become interested in Dharma, don't go so much. It sort of fades out. You know, you're interested in macrame, rock and roll, whatever. Whatever your interests, you know, that's what draws you together, first of all. And the context, your friendship builds up in the context of that. And sometimes they can be quite fragile, because that, in a way, is the only thing you've got in common with each other. The only thing you've got in common is the context of that friendship, like work or like whatever, your hobby or something. And when you step outside that, sometimes you find it a bit hard to talk about anything. But the context of these friendships is the context of the Dharma. So we are brought together by the Dharma. Spiritual friendship, we're brought together by the Dharma. I remember being in a support team meeting one time in the latter years, looking around the room and thought, God, I wouldn't choose to live with any of them. If I had a free choice, I wouldn't choose to live with these people. They wouldn't be my first choice, you know. Yet I feel like I'm really connected with them. When I see people now and again, I still feel that real strong bond of, well, we've shared something collectively, we work something through together, you know. So the conditions are the Dharma. This is the overriding, I suppose, standard, you could call it, value system that overrides this friendship, this spiritual friendship. And this is what can move a friendship on to Kalyanamitta, to spiritual friendship. In a way, it's Pratichasamutpada, isn't it, context. This is conditioned by that. All this happens by way of a cause. So you put yourself in certain situations, you're conditioned by that, you move out of them, the conditions change, the context of your friendship changes, sometimes the depth of your friendship and connection changes. So our friendship in the good life, as the quote says, is the friendship in the life of, in a way, of the FWO. I'm sorry, I haven't quite got used to the new name yet. I'm not sure everybody knows it. But our context is the is the FWO, or the Tree Ratna Buddhist community, or the Western Buddhist Order, or the Tree Ratna Buddhist Order. So I've got it right? Good. Mm. Yeah. So that's our context. Our context is friendship in the good life, in the holy life, in the wholesome life. And it is really when you bring your practice, your Dharma practice, to those friendships, so that it could, this, the context, you start going beyond just that context. You start going to something much higher. So in a way, it's just about being mindful of people, much more mindful in the spiritual sense of being mindful of yourself and others, and yourself in relation to others. You know, this is what starts breaking down that barrier. It starts questioning your sense of self. Who am I? You know, with friendships, there's a lot of rubbing up against each other, views, a bit of compromise, a bit of, you know, step back every so often. So you have to be aware of, you start becoming aware of who you are and who other people are, and you start getting to the real meat of things. It's not just on likes and dislikes. It's on you relating to people by their value system, by the Dharma. It's also friendship with metta, karuna, and mudita. It's about love. You know, it's about going beyond mere friendliness to love. It's about being, you know, engaging with people's, you know, when they're struggling, when they're, you know, when they've got to, what's the word, dukkha, that's it. We've all got dukkha. But, you know, it's like them sympathy and the appropriate response to people's dukkha. It's like celebrating and rejoicing in their merits, rejoicing in their good fortune. And it's, we have the precepts that overlie or underpin, either of those, overlie and underpin these friendships. So that's what takes it, that's the context we're in now. It's not mere friendliness, it's not mere hobbies, and it is a shared interest, but the holy life, the Dharma life, is more than an interest. It actually is a life. C2. C2. So, independence on ignorance arises karma formations. Independence on karma formations arises. Oh no, is that right? Yes, arises consciousness. Independence on consciousness arises name and form. Independence on name and form arises the six sense organs. Independence on six sense organs arises contact. Independence on contact arises feeling. So the next one is connection. So this is the psychophysical organism, illustrated by the wheel of life. We build up from our previous life, we get these samskaras, sense organs, we start making contact with other people. So when we make contact, we could make a connection if we wanted to. Depends on our feelings, isn't it? We can have feeling, we can be attracted and want to take more part and know people more, or we want to push them aside. Well, actually, really, we should just want to connect, which again goes beyond what I like and what I dislike. And part of our practice is cutting through all that stuff, likes and dislikes. So we meet a lot of people and we connect on all sorts of different levels. As Dennis Lehane, the crime writer, says, people are messy. They are different. They don't always fall into the category we want them to fall into. People are messy. Friendships are different. So, like, I was watching, there'll be a few references to things I watch, right? I was watching this series called Lonesome Dove. I don't know if you've ever seen it, Lonesome Dove. But there's the centre of it is this relationship between, it's a cowboy thing, between these two, well, Texas Rangers. One of them is like, he's always joking, you know? He's always bantering, always winding the other one up. One is totally taciturn and sort of grumpy, you know? And then you realise, actually, that's the way they communicate. That's their friendship. It's there. And underlying all that, they don't have to speak about it. They don't really have to talk about it. They know they'd go to the wire for each other. You know, they would fight for the death for each other in this thing. And friendships are different like that. It's all about banter. And at the end of this thing, one of them dies. And he says, look, as he's dying, he says to the other guy, you promised me that if I die before you, you take me back to Lonesome Dove, which is 2,000 miles away from there, and you bury me there. And so this guy takes his body back to, he just goes through all these difficulties because, that's what he promised his friend, So friendships are different. Friendships are different. With me and Serena, with him, it's like you have full-on running commentaries life all the time. He'd be coming in my bedroom, he'd be telling me what's going on, how he's feeling, blah, 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 day. Me, I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to talk about me, don't want to talk about you, right? I want to come in the room, I want to sing a few songs. And every so often I want to talk really seriously about what we're doing here, And how are you, mate? Okay, fine. Very, very different. Very different approach. People were different. The Buddha's friendship with Ananda was a very different friendship. Because there was a certain element, there's an element of, obviously, of hierarchy, but it was a different friendship. Sariputra and Moggallana, very, very different to the Buddha's and Ananda's friendship. Friendships are different. But we can make those connections with anybody if we like, if we're open to the fact that we don't just put people in there, I'm only going to mix with people like this, I'm only going to want to communicate with people like this. I know some people who don't like football, right? And I really like them. I mean, I'm puzzled, but I really like them. And it doesn't seem to have done anything well. I mean, I don't even know some people don't like the Rolling Stones, it's but, my likes and dislikes, in a way I'm joking, but I'm not joking, There are likes and dislikes. They happen to be my likes, and I actually like a lot of people who don't share those. But I feel connected with them, and a lot of the reason I feel connected is through the spiritual life, is through the context I live my life in. And, I try to do that outside. I mean, I'm not really, other than flirting with the waitresses in the coffee shops, I'm not out much. But I do try and treat people. I do try and make connection. Whoever I interact with is to see them rather than, see my response, my reaction to them. On the dependence on contact comes feeling. I try to step back and not go around the wheel again every time in the communication. Not always easy, because I'm a conditioned being, like all of us. But sooner or later, one finds yourself going beyond yourself, making the connection almost despite yourself. And when you're on a weekend retreat like this, it's like, there's the chance to do it. On a week's retreat, here are people, some of them you may not like so much. Some of them you see in a room and you say, I think I'll go and have a cup of tea. Some of you think, I'd like to know him. Because he's obviously, got whatever it is. But you do all these things, don't you? But actually just walk in a room and talk to people, connect with people, try and go beyond that. We've got a great chance on these sort of weekends. They're quite intensive, so we've got a chance to do it. And we'll have more chances as the weekend goes on. And you connect by being curious and interested in other people. Not just, I know I go in there and I just actually want to talk about me, because I'm incredibly interesting to me. But when I stopped drinking, I realised that actually it was quite a lesson. I was a steady drinker for quite a long time, rather than anything dangerous. But when I stopped and used to go down a pub and hear people talk, I thought, God, how boring are they? God, I must have sounded as boring as this. So when you think you're the centre of the universe, actually you might not be as interesting as you think you are. And actually, if you show more interest and curiosity about other people, you will start learning. You will start learning about yourself as well. And you'll start, you'll start being mindful of actually where, what are just your self-interested things. So, yes. So we want to know more about them. We need to connect with them. See them for what they are. See other people for what they are, not for what we want them to be or think they are. And it is the way of starting to move beyond self and other. The first fetter is fixed self-view. If we want to start changing that fixed self-view, we can do that in relation to other people and watch our responses to other people. Wish I'd had that water. Okay. No, that's all right. So the third C. So these are the sort of introductory ones. So you set the context, you make the connection. Now, these three are sort of the working ground, and the next two after that are the health warning. So the first thing is commitment. Banjo talks about commitment, meaning that you go deeper. You connect with people, you go deeper. If you commit yourself to a friendship, if you commit yourself to anything, you know, you will make progress in it. It's like going to Cardiff, you know, we committed ourselves to the project. We said we'd be there at least 5, probably 10 years, you know, and we committed ourselves to it. I mean, luckily it was fun. I'm not sure where I'd felt we hadn't been. But, you know, you commit yourself to something, things open up. In the Taste of Freedom talk the Banji does, he sees that commitment is an antidote to superficiality. So you can, if you commit yourself, you go deeper. You've got the potential to go deeper. This is part in the Tiger's Cave. If you commit yourself, I think it was another Banji quote that you can't commit yourself to the known. So with a friendship and with anything, you know, you don't actually know. You may have a good idea. What is going to happen when you take those next steps? What is going to happen when you go that little bit beyond yourself? You don't really know. I mean, you could be rejected. You could go deeper, which for some of us, or some of you, sorry, some of us is a very, very frightening thing. You know, suddenly you having to look at parts yourself you don't really want to look at. You've drawn out of, you know, I like to do things the way I like to do things. And then you meet some people that you sort of rub up against and you think, well, maybe the way I used to do things isn't quite the best way of doing them. But your initial response is, I'm right. But if you commit yourself to it, you've got to commit yourself to being wrong. You've got to commit yourself to change. You've got to open yourself up to all the other parts of yourself. And I think the other parts of yourself, I used to have this thing, there's this murky tray of of negativity around. If anybody saw it, would be the finish of me, you know. But as the murky trays come into the light, it's like, well, actually, it's not that murky. Actually, some of it isn't murky at all, some of it's quite good. There's a bright light shines on it, and it's some good stuff. So you commit yourself, your friendships deepen. You're taken, you're challenged, you're taken to places you don't want to go. I mean, as I said before, people are not only messy, but they're different. So you commit yourself to a project with other people, you'll find out how different they are and how different you are. So friendships are different, people are different, people have different friendships. As I talked a bit in the last section, you know, they're just different ways of doing this. There is no template, you know, that a friendship is like this. I think one of the things we can think is, well, to have a really good friendship, it has to be expressed in this way. There are general principles in friendship, like openness, honesty, disclosure, generosity, etc., etc. But the way they manifest is different in different people. So when you commit yourself to these friendships, you know, you're going to have to be open to other people won't do it quite the same as you, and you won't do it quite the same as them. But that is all right. That's all right, okay? You are different. And it needs, when there are difficulties, you to step beyond yourself and go that little bit further. That's what commitment means, going that bit further. In Subhuti's talks in the spiritual friendship in whenever he did, probably about 1989, I think, he used a bit of the duties of brotherhood in Islam as the basis for some of these talks, which I think probably shocked a few people to some. But actually, having a quick look at the duties of brotherhood, it's a real, they're really, you know, there's no messing, is there? If you want a friendship, you know, you make a commitment. And there was a time, I don't know if Subhuti's still got that, I think maybe in Pavavadra, and they might tell you later, people actually wrote contracts of friendship in the movement. And I think other people here. I mean, I'm not saying you have to do that, but it's very interesting. You write it down. There's your commitment in black and white. This is what I'm going to do. And the duties of brotherhood are like that. You know, it's saying, well, you offer material aid. Your duty is material aid, personal aid. You hold your tongue. You don't criticise just for the sake of it. You speak out and defend your friends. You forgive them their faults. All things like this, all very, very strong stuff. You know, you when you take stuff on, when you commit yourself, in a way you're moving from this thing, you're moving towards a more dutiful relationship with your friends. Benji talks in his talk, Rights and Duties. Duties and Rights, Rights and Duties. Duties consist in what is due from us to others and are based on giving, whereas rights consist on what is due from others to us and are based upon grasping and getting. And he also said the performance of duties results in the establishment of love and peace. Duties that unite, rights divide. So when we commit ourselves, in a way, maybe we can think in terms, if it's not too onerous to us, in terms of what we can give to the friendship. What is the duty? What is my duty in this? Am I looking out for my friend, you know? Am I looking out for their material needs? Am I looking for just for what I can get? Or am I looking at what I can give? So I don't know if contracts, I mean, people might talk in groups later about their experience of those. But I think there is a time and there is a place for being much more overt about your commitment to the friendship. I don't think, you know, one has to not be naive about these things and make these incredible statements that you can't keep too early. But if you've got an established friendship, you know, you sort of can sign yourself in blood, if you like. I remember when I was here, when we first started the support team, I remember sort of saying to him, I've never said this to Surina, but I said to myself, I would serve him, because I knew he was brilliant in his way, but he also flawed in other ways. And he needed somebody who was, you know, who's fairly steady and consistent behind him. And at times, I would do stuff that wouldn't be what I wanted to do. I mean, I never said this to him, but I said it to myself, I'd do that for a year to make this thing work. And it seems to have worked. I think it worked, anyway. Well, there's a support team now who seems to be growing, so we must have started something good, anyway. But it was an interesting thing to do, because, you know, like all of us, my opinion is obviously the best. And I want to be heard, you know. But there's times when I just step back and, okay, I'll let him run. If he makes his mistakes, well, I'll sympathise and whatever. But I just serve this and serve the situation. So duties, as Banti said, are softly and sweetly laid upon us by the voice of the divine. So the duties shouldn't be an onerous thing. Our commitment shouldn't be an onerous thing. It should be something that leads to the divine. You see beyond it, you realise it actually, it can take you somewhere far from where you are, in a much better place. Okay. So the next one is, the next C is communication. Communication. I don't know why I laugh there. But I want to say, first of all, communication isn't an exact science. It's not a technique. Okay? It's not exact science. It's not a technique. Personally, MVC, NLP, I've got nothing. I don't want it. I want to talk to people. I want to communicate with people. I want to talk to people. And I want there to be a living being who's talking to me from, you know, an authentic place. That's what I want. I don't want a technique, and it's not a science. Anyway, that's my rant for today. So it starts, communication starts with interest and curiosity. Add a dash of common sense and awareness and a bit of meta, you've got communication. It takes, I look at it as people, as foreign countries. This is what, we're foreign countries. Now, I come from England, right? Which used to be the centre of the universe. I come from England. Some people come from England and live in Norfolk. So they're not that far, you know. Our language is fairly the same. You know, we might say the same words, but the cultural is slightly different. The cultural references are different. So we can understand each other. Some people I meet who are English speak the same language, but they could be speaking from out of Mongolia, as far as I'm concerned. You know, it's sort of, they just, you know, we say the same words, but the meaning is totally different on them. And it's like you're a foreign country. So what do you do with that? Now, you could do the John Cleese, Britain rules the empire thing of just shouting louder at them. You will understand, you know. You could do that. But It doesn't work, does it? As I understand it. It doesn't work. So what we have to do, in a way, is have a guidebook. Is actually take an interest in their culture. If you go abroad, you know, you want to eat if you're abroad. You know, you have to learn to out order the food, don't you? You've at least got to do that. So with communication, you've at least got to make an effort to find at least a common ground somewhere an in into somebody else's, the way they speak or what they mean. You just have to find a common language and take an interest in their culture, which is, again, going back to things, you take an interest in them. You know, you don't, you know, it's not just about you. You take an interest in them and what they're interested in. You try and learn their language, and even if, you know, they do speak out of Mongolian or whatever that is, they speak in out of Mongolian, you can at least, you know, you can get across what you mean by a bit of effort and a bit of will. You can step out of your zone of comfort. I don't like saying comfort zone, it's not a zone of comfort. You can step out of that and into theirs and try and find the sign language, at least, that will make you communicate. So you set the groundwork, you know, in this. You sort of, maybe you buy a guidebook, you know, you go to somebody else, you know so-and-so. I don't understand what they talk about. And they say, well, this and this. I remember this recently in something, and somebody said, well, I don't understand. I said, well, what you have to understand, he's like this, and this. Oh, right, okay. And it sort of smooths the way. But I think it is a lot to do with us holding on to our views and our sense of self and not making that little leap and step outside there. Now, I want to talk a bit about the speech precepts, because that's what we mainly do. We speak, we talk. Can I read you, this is Dennis Lehane, this is my controversial quote from Dennis Lehane, right? I know society tells us it's good to talk about ourselves, to discuss with friends or a qualified stranger, and it may be so. But I often think we talk too much in this society, that we consider verbalisation a panacea that is very often not, and that we turn a blind eye to the sort of morbid self-absorption that becomes predictable byproduct of it. So sometimes we talk too much, and sometimes if we don't talk in the right way, it does become self-absorption, self-referential. So we do have to, it's great that we communicate. You know, when I grew up, you know, communication was all right. Yeah, all right. It was, you know, it was low-key, a bit of jokes, blah, blah, blah. But actually, it's a good thing that we're more, you know, we verbalise more and we do make the effort. But it, you know, it's an overkill lately. I've noticed an overkill. It also might be the fact that I seem to be losing patience and I'm getting older, but that's another thing. So the speech precepts. We're asked to speak truthfully in our communication. So that's being, you know, I think that's talking as authentically as possible. We talk harmoniously. So we don't immediately, you know, slag somebody off or think they're talking the wrong thing, get into them, you know, blah, blah, blah. So we talk harmoniously. We try and understand. We try and smooth the way for the to learn that other language. We talk kindly and graciously. Again, the same sort of thing, you know. We're kind to people. We listen to them. And we speak helpfully. Actually, when we're communicating, we're trying to get to the truth. This is what it seems to me with each other. We're trying to get the truth about ourselves and the universe, in a way. The mysteries, as whatever his name is. Can't remember his name. Love him. Can't remember his name. I said, the mysteries of the universe. And also, I think it's important that we look at the speech precepts in terms of listening. So we listen with an open heart. We listen openly. We don't, you know, so we listen truthfully. We try and get, you know, our habitual responses out of the way. We're much more open to that. We listen. We hear what other people say. We actually hear it rather than what we want to hear. We hear it. We try and truthfully hear what they've got to say. We try and openly engage with that. We try and openly hear what they've got to say. We listen with metta. We don't suspect their motives behind what they're talking about. You know, we listen with metta. We're not trying to think, well, obviously when they say that, they mean that, don't they? You know, and they're having a bit of a pop, you know, sort of thing. Which is you know, I've done there again. And we listen helpfully in terms of trying to move the communication forward, trying to make it deeper, move it forward. We listen with helpfully and openly. Yes, so we listen with the precepts as well as talk with the precepts. So Banti talks about communication being a benefit and a blessing of being able to share our thoughts and feelings. A common exploration of the spiritual life by people who are honest and in full harmony. We can share our enthusiasms, inspiration, understanding, and even our mistakes. And it's not merely verbal. In silence particularly, we can be particularly attuned to people. So, you know, we communicate on lots of levels. And one of the great things of having silence on retreat is suddenly it gets a bit more subtle how you communicate. You know, it's very interesting what happens if you have a prolonged period of silence. On the ordination course, I remember we had about 35 days, I remember, of silence. And it was those things where you start to hand people things at the table before they even ask, you know. There was a tuning in that goes on. And sometimes the verbal communication can get in the way of that communication. Which is why, you know, one of the reasons why we have silence on retreats. So something else can come into play. So, number five. I've called this caring. Now, not caring in, you know, not that sort of caring. You won't hear that on the tape. But in a sense, a caring of looking after, looking out for our friends, you know. A caring not only in compassionate sense, but in a vigilance. In a sense of vigilance. Because things can go wrong very, very easily. You know, miscommunication can lead you to a place where you don't want to be. So you have to be vigilant in a friendship. And again, it's this mindfulness of that things change, don't they? Your friends change, you change. And it's one of the things I've been seeing in, you know, we've got quite a lot of married people around the centre whose children left home. And suddenly there's this whole readjustment they have to do in their relationship with you. It's a good example because suddenly certain reasons you were there go, like children leave home, you retire, you live in the same house where actually you only used to see each other for supper, watch the telly, go to bed, you know. Suddenly you're around each other. And that's what friendship's like, that's what people are like. Hopefully we're all developing and changing. So we'd have to try and be in tune with that. And sometimes, you know, and we have to, we don't have to do anything, sorry. What we do is we try and keep on top of that and maintain a friendship through that. Go with our friends. Hopefully they go with us when we move on. I mean, I go in terms of we adjust to those movements. It's a very fluid and it's quite a subtle thing. It doesn't. Sometimes it's obvious. Somebody will move somewhere, take a different job, and suddenly life becomes very different for them. You can't see them so much, etc., etc. Well, that happens on that big level. It also happens on a level of people just change gradually. I mean, my experience of the spiritual life is like there is that gradual changing and refining, hopefully, of our ethical sensibilities, of our understanding of what reality is, of other people, etc. So those changes come, and hopefully, this by caring and looking out for each other, you take on that with each other. You start moving with each other. You start inspiring each other and, in a way, prodding each other to move on. It's very, very difficult. If your friend only wants to come to the Buddhist centre once a month and go back to drinking a bottle of wine a night, and you actually want to meditate every day, and again, these are quite crude examples, but it does, suddenly your friendship takes a whole different, you know, a whole different dimension. And where do you go with that? You know, what do you do with that? So in a way, you have to look out for people. You have to look out for each other. Be alive to the possibility of these things happening, or they have happened, and take steps to do something about it. You can't let, you know, these things go on too long. There's also a positive sense that you don't sit on your laurels. I mean, the whole idea of the spiritual life is this gradual change and growth in us. We change, hopefully, for the better. And we don't sit on our laurels. We want to go, actually, it'd be good to go a bit further. I mean, one thing's about Sariputra and Mogulana was that thing which was mirrored in the West Wing, actually, where, you know, he said, well, if you find the person, you know, the person who knows the reality, you'll come back and tell me, you know, and we can go for it. And I don't suppose he said it in the sutras like that, but, you know, we actually go for it. And any relationship, you know, is like that. You know, you're trying to move each other on, you're trying to engage with each other, push each other to even greater heights. That's what I call about caring about people. You know, it's like doing all these things. We get better, we move on, more challenges come, we develop. So that's what our friendship should be like. It should be this real, yes, okay, you take people with you, they take you with you. It's an exchange. So in the Sigalavada Sutta, it says that a true friend, there's a quick nip there, true friends are helpers, they're there through thick and thin, give you good counsel, and are loving as well. So this caring is born out in the Sigalavada Sutta, which has some great lists of what friendship is. And I have actually got some handouts, which I'll leave on the table later on when I pin them together, from the Sigalavada. So true friends watch our backs, they're reliable, they give open-handedly, they're just vigilant, they just keep an eye on us, you know, they watch out for us all the time. They're trying to make sure that we're all right. They even, it says they take on you and your property. So our true friend, the helpful friend, is always looking out for your benefit. It's always, and hopefully that's what you're doing with your friends. They're there through thick and thin. They're constant. There's a fidelity with your friendship. You know, you may not be with them all the time, but there is this fidelity and constancy. And that fidelity and constancy gives you confidence in the friendships. And there's a discretion that's there in a friendship. You know, you don't tell your friends secrets, etc. And it says in there that you will even give your life for them. You know, you're through thick and thin, you will even give your life. So you'll put yourself on the line for your friends. And they bring a degree of wisdom to the situation, an ethical perspective. They give you the benefit of their experience to what it is. And hopefully, you know, when that's happening, that can lead you to at least insights with a small eye, hopefully to the bigger insights. So there's a degree of wisdom. You know, they give good counsel, friends. You know, they're coming from a place of ethics, of mindfulness, of metta. So they want to help. They want to give you their counsel. They want to benefit you. And they share your joys and they rejoice in your merits. And they rejoice in your merits. They stick up for you. They stick through thick and thin. You know, they're just there for you. Even if you're wrong in a sense, they're there for you. They might not say, I agree, but they're there for you to support you to find out if they are wrong. It's a very interesting list, this, I find. You know, the helper through thick and thin, give counsel, and are loving. You know, that's what they say. That's what it says a true friend is, all those things.